What's the story of fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi's life? He'll tell us himself when he joins us to talk about his new memoir, I Am. Has ensuring freedom of the press gotten more difficult in an era of alternative facts and attacks on the press? Our own Deputy General Counsel, David McCraw, will be here to talk about his new book, Truth in Our Times. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, our critics will talk about the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast for the New York Times. I'm Pamela Paul. Isaac Mizrahi joins us now. He is a fashion designer, a cabaret singer, an author, and many other things. And he has written a memoir called I Am. Isaac, thank you for being here.
So thrilled, really.
So I began this book and immediately could see that you were very much a book person, in addition to, I imagine, being a cabaret person and a fashion person and other things. But your epigraph is to Susan Sontag. In the very first paragraph of your introduction or your prologue, you write about reading the multi-volume series A History of Private Life, which was not, those were not short books. That was about sort of the entirety of Western civilization. And your mother gave you Colette when you were 13.
Yes, this is so true. Yes, I do have a history with kind of self-educating because I feel like I missed a big part of my education in that way. I was always a little bit sort of overcompensative about the issue of reading because I went to Parsons and it was really like a very heavy fashion background. But then, you know, then you kind of sacrifice a lot of college reading lists, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I always doubled back in terms of reading. Also, I had this best friend who I actually write about in the book called Kevin. And Kevin and I used to exchange. He was a really great, I'm not exactly sure where he got his reading lists from, but we used to kind of trade reading lists. And that was a book that we both kind of explored together. We loved those books, The History of Private Life.
The History of Private Life. I remember back, I think it was in the 80s, that was sort of part of the, you could order those from the History Book Club, you know, which was like the very dorky book version,
exactly.
Like Columbia House Records, but you could
right.
get.
Yes, exactly. except they're marvelous. I mean, they're really not, they're not just dorky and they're not Columbia House-esque at all. They're sort of like amazing volumes to have.
Yes. And I like those. And I also like there are a lot of museums that kind of look at that history of private life too, where you can sort of, you know, see the teacups that people drank from and that kind of
right.
thing. More in England
than
here. But I want to go deeper into your education because a lot of what you write about in the book are your formative years. And I want to start with your growing up in Brooklyn and going to the local yeshiva and what that was like for you.
Well, it is a local yeshiva, but it is a really renowned one as well. Yeshiva Flatbush. I mean, it's a really great school for the right people. It wasn't exactly the right school for me, but I always take such pride in the fact that I graduated from that place, only because the curriculum was so massive. Even though it was the wrong place for me, I developed a lot of really useful habits, and I definitely learned this kind of overachievement thing that I continued on for my life. It was the formative overachievement experience.
When you say it wasn't the right experience for you, I mean, these were not happy years for you, right? You were bullied in that school.
Right. I was really bullied in that school, yes, for sure. And I should make this clear. Bullying never made me retreat. It only kind of inspired me to fight. You know what I mean? And I'm not exactly sure where I got that gene from. I think my mom or something, but I do think about the kids in schools who get bullied who don't have the instinct to fight and who do retreat, you know, and I worry so much about them. I was really lucky in that I was resolute, you know, and I should double back and say that for all of the bullying that took place with not just my peers, but also like, you know, the rabbis were bullies in those days, right? Like if they didn't understand what was going on and they wanted you to comply with rules and religious rules, they were bullies. I mean, they were like, you know, mean. And I will say that even among all of the bullying and the wrong education, I mean, it was all like Torah and Talmud and Gemara and all of those subjects. And I was very bored by those subjects. But I also learned another language. I learned to speak Hebrew. I actually learned to read Hebrew and learned to read Aramaic because that was part of the curriculum, and that's a crazy amount of stuff to learn on top of the English studies classes that we had. You know, so I like the idea of being on that crazy treadmill of education at such a young age and being taught to prioritize it that way, you know? And yet the bullying was a difficulty. It also shaped the way I kind of move through the world. I am prepared for the worst at all times. I am
still
prepared. Yes. I mean, I think it has made me like a paranoid person, you know?
Right. Which can be useful.
I think so. You know, I do. I think so. Expect the worst, right?
Yes. Like be a kind of walking worst case scenario handbook.
Yes, indeed.
So you went from the yeshiva to what was probably the polar opposite school in the landscape of New York City schools, which was the High School of Performing Arts. How did that happen?
That's right. Also known as LaGuardia, by the way, that school. But it was, I describe it in the book, it's like a kind of culture shock that is almost indescribable. And also followed by a great deal of guilt, if you understand, right? So you're going from this incredibly conservative yeshiva to this incredibly liberal place, right? Where just everybody was either pregnant or, you know, on drugs or something. It was crazy. And it was like this culture shock with a large side order of guilt at every turn. Any piece of bacon was, you know, this guilty thing, or any boy in a dance belt, you know, it was, oh my God, right? I had a bad year of adjustment, even though it was the most fabulous thing in the world to arrive there. Still, it was like very, very difficult. And I describe in the book taking these walks at lunch to kind of escape the whole thing for a minute and just get perspective on what the hell was, you know, happening. And I do see that, by the way, as one of the recurring themes of my life. And I think in the book, which is this idea of kind of being taught optimism, you know,
mm-hmm.
You have this really bad start, right? Not least the yeshiva, but also the spinal meningitis. It was a really kind of rough childhood, let's put it that way. And then suddenly at the age of, I guess, 13 and a half or whatever age you start high school, to be thrust into the most perfect and beautiful situation, you really do go like, wait a minute. Maybe it's not all that horrible, right? And you learn to keep an open mind and keep it cool for a minute until the situation changes. And that has been like this thing throughout my life, and it keeps happening. I talk about the political situation we're in now, and I think the only thing to think about is the next moment.
Right.
You can't think about this moment. You can only think about the next moment coming.
What were your parents, I mean, were they supportive of this transition from the yeshiva to the High School of Performing Arts? And what did you go there wanting to be?
My parents were in a very, very strange position. And I talk about this a lot, about how the world has changed in the past 35 or 40 years, and how narrow the vision was in the community that they came from.
Which is a Syrian Jewish.
The Syrian Jewish community. And this is not exactly an apology for their narrowness. More, it's just a kind of preface to the answer to the question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they had a very difficult time letting me go to that school. They had a very difficult time broadening their view of the world, right? And allowing me to go even broader than that. You know, I mean, merely taking the subway an hour each way from Brooklyn to the city, 46th Street, right? That was a big leap for them to allow me to do that. And it was all due to this incredible teacher that I had in eighth grade called Sheila Kanowitz. She changed her name, and I've been trying to reach her. If anybody's listening to this and know who Sheila Kanowitz became when she got married, I'd love to send her a copy of the book at the very least. But anyway, so Sheila Kanowitz kind of understood that I was in the wrong situation. She looked at it objectively and she was like, maybe you should go to this wonderful school I've heard about in New York City called Performing Arts. And she helped me with the audition. She helped me convince my parents, right? And so I owe her that. She really changed my life in such a major way, in such a major way.
Did she understand who you were, do you think, before you had an understanding? Or did you have a kind of strong sense of yourself at that stage?
I had a strong sense of who I was. I was making puppets and doing these crazy and very inappropriate female impersonations, you know, by the way, in Bible class, you know, for people. They didn't know who Dionne Warwick was, probably, but there I was doing these crazy impersonations in shul. So I had a sense of who I was, but it didn't matter because I didn't have a sense of the school that I should be going to. I was at odds. I was like, well, I'm not going on with the yeshiva because that's just that. I'm an adult enough to know that this is the wrong environment. So I'm not doing that, right? And it's my choice. Finally, like, you know, somehow when you get to high school age, parents kind of go, okay, what do you want to do, right? And I knew I didn't want to do that yeshiva thing anymore. But as far as the actual school I should go to, I would have needed the guidance of somebody like that, right? So I had a sense, but she had a sense just from observing me and knowing me as a teacher knows a student. And I just think that's the greatest kind of observation and the greatest kind of educator step in kind of thing. I mean, that was a real, almost like a crazy intervention.
So you're talking about puppets and female impersonation. When did your interest get drawn specifically to fashion?
I was at Performing Arts High School, and I was so sure I was going to do the show business. And somehow, the priority of making my way out of the community and out of my parents' house, right, that became the priority. And I kept thinking, like, well, what's the easiest way to do that? You know, I'm certain that in order to be an actor, you have to really, really kill yourself to get a gig. And then that one goes away. And then what do? And you keep just waiting for gigs. And it's really not a steady income. Somehow I thought that getting a job in a fashion house as an assistant or whatever would be more real and would be easier in New York City, having had exposure to the garment district through my dad, right? It was just more tangible and just seemed easier. So I abandoned my dreams of going into show business for the sake of making my way in the world and earning the money to get out of the very narrow situation I was born into. And it worked. And I think it's described in the book as this real fork in the road where you go, yeah, I better do this. So roughly like my third year in high school, I kind of made the decision to actually go to Parsons. And I was making clothes and I was sewing. My dad taught me how to sew a little bit. And I bought my first sewing machine when I was a kid. And, you know, he gave me these scissors for my bar mitzvah. It's a whole thing. I mean, it was like a ritual, like a rite of passage, you know?
A pair of scissors for your bar mitzvah. That's such an
Two
interesting...
Two pairs of scissors,
wow.
Yeah. Two pairs of scissors, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know, it's a crazy thing. It's a funny thing. And with my name kind of engraved on the scissors, it's really funny. I mean, who gets that? You know, that's like a hint, right?
Right.
And yet, I remember the scene in the car with him. I used to drive home with him from the city because he worked on 34th Street across the street from Macy's. And so I would meet him there rather than take the subway home after school, and we would drive home. At some point, he said, oh, you know, do you want to go into my business and blah, blah. I guess he was working on his will or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him just flatly, no. But the good thing was that it was this kind of entree, like whether or not I was going into the children's wear business, which was his business, I still decided midway through high school to go into the garment business. And so there was all of this entree.
So you thought the fashion world would be easy or relatively easy compared with, say, the theater world or Hollywood. But
yes.
I mean, fashion is not an easy place to get your start.
No. Well, it relatively for me, it was. I could see the path very clearly. I got accepted to Parsons. I worked very hard there. I was sent on a lot of very, very, very good job interviews, starting in not even my final year, but my second to last year, right? At Parsons, I started getting sent out on interviews, and I landed, I think, the best job in my grade, which was to work for Perry Ellis, who at the time was absolutely the darling of the fashion business.
This was the 1980s.
Yes, it was like 1980 or something like that, or yeah, maybe even 79 or 80. It was a great, great job. And I do remember thinking really plainly, well, now I'll be able to leave home, you know, now I'll be able to actually start my life.
What was the fashion world like back then? I know that's a kind of big question, and I want to contrast it with what it's like today.
Well, my first impulse in answering that question is that the fashion world was grand in those days, absolutely grand, in a way that cannot be imagined anymore. And I write this long essay about textiles, right, sort of smack in the middle of the book. And I guess that's a generational thing where every generation looks back and says, oh, you'll never see the quality of textiles anymore. They'll just never be able to produce these things anymore, etc. And it's always true, by the way. It's always true. But I talk about these textiles in this way, and I think that kind of encapsulates what the fashion world was like. The idea, first of all, that designers would overcompensate with fabrics in such a way. I go into it in the book, but you're kind of hedging your bets. Like if some of them don't come in or some of them come in wrong, then you have so many more to choose from and you won't be left in the lurch to do your collection, right? To design your collection, you have your show. And the same was said for shoes. You know, if you're working on shoes, maybe some of the corrections wouldn't be done. So to hedge your bets, you would order five times as many shoes for the show. And hence, that would mean like literally hundreds of pairs of shoes for every show from license or from Manolo Blahnik, who I worked with very early on in my career. And I was talking to Veronica Webb, and she was saying, darling, we were raised in Versailles.
She was a major model at the time.
Yes, Veronica Webb was a mad supermodel at the time. And she was absolutely right because of the levels, the incredible budgets, the spending that went on in publishing as well, and at magazines. I remember when Grace Mirabella was running Vogue, all you heard about, you never heard about merely like sittings, you heard about reshoots and reshoots and reshoots. Because if they didn't like an eyebrow, they had to reshoot. They couldn't touch it up. I mean, they could probably, but they would reshoot it, just go to the trouble. It was crazy. It wasn't just about one story. It was about reshooting that story until it was right. And now I don't think anybody, I mean, you're lucky if you order 20 pairs of shoes for your collection.
Wow.
And you're lucky if you get to shoot once, half a day. You know what I mean? It's just such a different world.
But you closed your own label before a lot of these current trends happened, before the magazines diminished or dwindled, before budgets were cut, before fast fashion, before social media, before the end of supermodels. Why did you leave fashion in 1998?
I'll tell you what, I had this agreement with Chanel, and it didn't work out even with best intentions on both sides. It just didn't work out because I didn't understand what they wanted and they didn't exactly understand what I wanted. And so it didn't work. And eventually we just parted ways. And so I closed my doors in 1998. And so that was something that was part like choice, but part it happened. You know what I mean? I think I probably could have stopped it from happening, but the real sensical choice at the time was to say, look, I tried and it's not going to work and I'm going to close. That's another kind of theme of the book. What happens and what do you make happen? And it's really unclear. It's really hard to tell because if you look at the trajectory of my story as a fashion designer, I move closer and closer towards accessibility as an image. I move further and further away from this couturier who makes these fabulous dresses for red carpet and trunk show customers, and more and more and more towards, well, the whole Target thing, right? And the whole QVC thing. That's where I live right now. That's where I ended up living in a happier way. I'm happier when things make sense. And to me, it makes sense to be more inclusive. It always was. And that was something about the whole designer thing that happened that I didn't foresee. I didn't realize that by making these precious, expensive, edgy clothes, that only a very small percent of the demographic would be able to reach for them. And the thing is, I'm especially happy now because in the interim, I've had a one-person show on Off-Broadway. I've worked at a number of fabulous clubs and music halls and theaters across the country. I've had a talk show for 7 years. I've really done other things that I was really seemingly more interested in. And that's the truth. And whether I made that happen or that actually just happened to me, regardless, I am happier. I'm using the word happy now, which is a big, giant word to use.
Now you have this whole career as a cabaret performer and travel around the country doing cabaret. You've said that people were surprised to find out that you were doing cabaret, and your response was that if it's actually kind of more surprising that you had ended up doing fashion. How did you end up doing cabaret?
Again, it was something that I could not stop doing. And going to performing arts high school and knowing all these people and going to see their shows and cabarets and sometimes collaborating with them here and there and somehow just circuitously getting involved in the circuit of those shows. Like, I'm not exactly sure how you stop something like that because it's so darn fun. It's probably the most expressive thing for me possible to get on a stage and just tell stories and sing. And so, you know, you try and repress that, darling. You simply cannot.
All of this, obviously, is territory that you cover in the memoir, which I understand you've been working on for a number of years and that came out of diaries that you've kept since 1996. What was it like to go back through all of those diaries and to turn this into a book?
Frankly, I use the diaries a little bit. And here and there, I actually quote the diaries. But the structure of the book didn't necessarily come from the diaries. The structure of the book came from really just my telling the story and trying to find recurrent themes that might take me back on track. And the first essay that I write is this thing about Rosebud and, like you said, the history of private life, right? And what of the minutiae do you actually retain in the book and what do you just cut off like a limb to keep the thing moving propulsively? And so the structure of the book came from just trying to write almost a novel. And I'm going to tell you this. I took the whole job, if you will, for a very mercenary reason, because I've always seen myself as a writer between the journals and articles that I write, etc. And I wrote a graphic novel a long time ago called Sandy the Supermodel. And I've always wanted to write a book. And I thought, well, here's my chance to write a book. And so the structure came from my trying to write almost a novel about my history.
So the entire time that everyone thought that you were a fashion designer, and then the entire time that people thought that, no, really at heart, you are a cabaret singer or a TV performer or a film star, you're actually an author at heart and a writer.
Right. Well, you see what I'm saying, right? And by the way, I don't think that people are only good at one thing. I think people can be good at a lot of different things. And somehow, I think it's easier for people to understand how Pharrell Williams or something like that can go from being this incredible musician to doing these incredibly divine clothes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like somehow that's just an easier thing to think. So I think the segue can work the other way too, where you can start as a designer and then just give in and do other things.
Well, you've written a very good book. It's called I Am a Memoir by Isaac Mizrahi. Isaac, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela Paul.
And here's a clip from one of his recent cabaret performances.
You're the top. You're the Dalai Lama. You're the top. You're Michelle Obama. You're the recipes for my mac and cheese with ham. You're the real Pete Diddy. You're Hello Kitty. You're Instagram. You're a sale found on Net-a-Porter.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. I'm very happy to have here a very popular person here at the New York Times, not in the newsroom, but our deputy general counsel, David McCraw. He also has a new book. It's called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you. And that title's a mouthful and you got it all out. I appreciate that.
I managed to get it all out. Well, you managed to get a lot more out word-wise in your book. This is your first book, right?
It is indeed.
This must have started with this letter that you wrote, or did it not? Did you plan to write this book?
It really started with the letter. Some things had happened before that that made me aware that the First Amendment was very poorly understood in the United States and by citizens, and I thought it was important that they should know about it. But I first began to think about the book and be approached by people about writing a book after the letter.
All right, let's start with the letter then. For those who have not read the letter, what was that letter? When did you write it? To whom was it written and why?
During the campaign, we ran a story about two women who claimed they had been groped by Donald Trump much earlier. And I thought it was a really solid story, in part because we explained all the reasons that people might question their story. And that's what we should do with readers. We should make readers aware of the facts they need to know and let them come to their own decision about things. The Trump campaign, needless to say, was unhappy with the story. We received a letter from Donald Trump's lawyers saying that they were going to sue us if we didn't retract the story. And I responded to that with my letter. I knew it was going to go public. They had made their letter public. I had no idea it would have the response that it did.
What did you say in that letter?
In some ways, it was a straightforward legal letter. I laid out what would be our defense if Donald Trump really intended to sue us, which I didn't think was all that likely. But I also thought that if he had a lot of time on his hands after November 8th, maybe suing us would be what he would do instead of being president. So I talked about how his reputation had not been harmed by that story because his reputation in regards to women was in a fairly sad shape through his own behavior and his own words. But I think it was the ending that ended up capturing people's attention, which stated that we had the right to do this under the First Amendment. And if he disagreed, I welcomed the opportunity to have a court set him straight.
Well, that all sounds very staid and lawyerly, but there was a little bit of literary flourish in that letter.
I think so. I think so. People tell me that. I did write it fairly quickly. I did use structures that I'd used before. I think that most of my letters probably end in a more accommodating, call me if you have questions, or would welcome the chance to talk with you further about this. But I really thought that this was a moment that people had been concerned about how often Donald Trump threatened everybody, anybody who was taking a position he disagreed with. I thought it was important that we stand up and make a strong statement, and that's what I tried to do.
And the response was remarkable. I think it was perhaps one of the few times that sort of an in-house counsel legal letter went viral. And what was the response from the Trump campaign?
I did not hear back from the Trump campaign. Later on, I talked to Donald Trump's lawyer. We have a long and civil and good relationship. I think that they felt they had made their point for their supporters. They had challenged the story. It was time for them to move on. And as I say in the book, for me, the really telling response was how journalists felt about it. And then there was a split in the House. There were journalists who were uncomfortable with what I had done.
How so?
I think not at the Times, but outside the Times, there were columns written and interviews given where journalists would say it seemed too much of an adversarial position, mm-hmm. that it's important that we don't engage directly in that. I disagree with that. My role is to advocate for our journalists, for our company, and for our newspaper. And when we're being threatened with a libel suit, I need to respond. The idea that somehow the appropriate time for that is in court is a misunderstanding of how the system works. Most things don't go to court. And it's a long time afterwards. This required response immediately.
So this was advocating on behalf of the Times, on behalf of our journalists and what we do here. But the book really takes it a step further, right, to advocate for press freedom overall.
That's right. We had done a story prior to the letter. We'd done a story about Donald Trump's tax returns. Three pages from state tax returns from 1995 that had been leaked to Sue Craig in the newsroom. She and her colleagues did an incredible job of reporting that story out and explaining from these three documents that it appeared that Mr. Trump hadn't paid taxes for two decades. And the story comes out on a Saturday night, and I'm at Yankee Stadium on Sunday afternoon, and Sue calls me and says, have you seen the Washington Post? And I tried to explain to her how baseball works. We don't read the Washington Post at the baseball game. And I signed on through my phone to the Post. And there was a story that said that we had risked legal trouble by publishing the tax returns. I was convinced that the law is exactly to the contrary. And it occurred to me that if the Washington Post in a serious column thought that this may violate the First Amendment to publish information that we had received that's in the public interest, we'd done a really bad job of explaining the First Amendment. There was a survey that I saw last year. 26% of the people who responded said the president should have the right to close down news organizations that, quote, misbehave. unquote. That to me suggests we've missed something very fundamental for a lot of people about how the First Amendment works in this country.
And presidents have never particularly liked the press, especially after they are in office. But this is different with the Trump administration. What's changed? How are the attacks fundamentally different now from what they've been?
It's occurred to me that the difference is striking, even if we go back to Richard Nixon, who probably had the most contentious relationship with the press in recent times. The beginning of the movie, The Post, about the Pentagon Papers, you hear Nixon talking about the press. But in public, Nixon felt the need to say the usual platitudes about a free press and the importance of that. The hostility is different. I also think that to have the White House leading a campaign, which is ineffective and not going anywhere, to change the law so people can sue for libel more easily is unprecedented. It's not something I've seen before. It's not even an area where the president has particular power to do things. The jeering at the press at rallies is chilling. As I say in the book, it's almost understandable that someone who is getting tough press want to push back. That's Donald Trump. What's disconcerting is how many people go along with that idea that somehow the press is the enemy. I think it's really, really deadly for democracy. One of the things I would say is that, and one of the reasons why I feel I'm in a position to write about this issue in what I hope is a compelling way, is that I grew up in a very conservative place. My parents were both World War II veterans, grew up in a small town in Illinois. And if you were growing up in Illinois when I did, that meant that the governor went to jail. Two governors when I was a kid went to jail. A third one was indicted and got off. The Secretary of State of the state of Illinois, when he died, was found to have shoeboxes full of money in his office.
I'm going to date you here, but what period are you talking about?
Oh, you're going to date me. This would have been the 60s and into the early 70s. And the message you took away from that, if you were conservative or if you were a living, thinking human being, was that you can't trust government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I've always embraced the idea of the importance of a free press. That idea somehow dropped out of the conservative ideology.
Well, I want to get back to this current moment in a few minutes. But since you brought up your coming of age, how did you end up at the New York Times as a lawyer here?
I had the good fortune to be working at the New York Daily News in 2002. My colleague Adam Liptak, who was a lawyer at the New York Times and essentially was doing at the New York Times a job I was doing at the Daily News, decided that he wanted to pursue a career as a journalist. He's now done outstanding work, first as national legal correspondent here, and more recently as the Supreme Court correspondent. So he left and the job was open. They were doing kind of a quick search to find somebody to replace him. And I had been doing this work at the Daily News, so it was a natural fit. It was right after 9/11, and there was a whole lot of attention about how we were going to cover the aftermath of 9/11. My work at the Daily News had been very involved in helping our reporters get access to documents and news sites after the attacks on the World Trade Center.
But what drew you specifically to this intersection of journalism and the law?
I had been a journalism major in college. After I graduated, I worked at a newspaper in Iowa. I later was a newspaper columnist in a very small paper in upstate New York and did a lot of freelance writing. And
we now have proof that you've been a writer all along.
I've been a writer, but nobody cried the day I left journalism. I am much better positioned to contribute in my current role.
We're talking here about the letter that you wrote during the Trump campaign. I want to talk about the Weinstein case, which you also touch on in this book. But I imagine every day working as a deputy legal counsel for the New York Times isn't that exciting. Like, what does a day at the Times look like for you?
It is really a buffet, and a very, very long and varied buffet. I do everything from review contracts for our trucking when we're delivering newspapers and outer reaches of America and need to have a truck take the papers from a printing plant to a place to be distributed. I spend a lot of time on security, mm-hmm. talking about how to keep this building safe. I sit at the top of the of our pyramid for providing security services to our reporters abroad. And we have been very aggressive in suing the federal government and the state and local government for freedom of information violations, trying to help our reporters get information, get documents. That occupies a big part of our time. I think what surprises people is that what they assume my job is, vetting stories, actually plays a fairly small role in terms of the time commitment I make over the course of a week.
That's what most of us journalists worry about. But what keeps you up at night? What are the things that concern you most?
These days, it's the incredible pressure our people face abroad, our international correspondents. The world is a very coarse place these days. It used to be that reporters were seen even in hostile zones as honest brokers, people you needed to have there. Whichever side you were on in a conflict, you depended on reporters getting your version of the events out. Twitter's changed that. Facebook's changed that. They don't really need us to be telling their story. They can spread their story through their own medium. What we've seen is that the President of the United States calling the press the enemy of the people, a stain on society, purveyors of fake news, has created an epidemic. Mm-hmm. The worst governments in the worst place now have adopted that language, and they're using it to oppress their own press. But we're also seeing how they're using the same tools to make it very difficult for our reporters. We're under criminal investigation in Egypt. We are banned from going into Pakistan. Our website's blocked in China. And when the governments of those countries and other countries justify that, they come back to the very same words that we're hearing from the White House. And my concern is that those governments think the way to curry favor with the United States is to take up that kind of behavior.
I want to talk about another actual powerful threat that you had to contend with in the last couple of years, which was Harvey Weinstein. We've heard about what that was like from the perspective of the journalists, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, and they have a book in which I'm sure we'll hear a lot more coming out later this year. But what was that situation like for you as a counsel?
I had first become involved in assisting our reporters with Me Too stories. With the coverage of Bill O'Reilly, Emily Steele and Mike Schmidt had begun that reporting and had done incredible work. As that reporting was unfolding, the Weinstein reporting began. And from the very beginning, I certainly was on notice that there would be a lot of lawyerly pushback, and there was from the Weinstein camp. Jody had called me and said, I'm starting this reporting. I think it's going to be very difficult. The allegations are incredible. The behavior that I'm being told about is beyond anything that anybody had heard about Harvey Weinstein before. My initial reaction was that I had been through a lot of difficult stories before. I had seen a lot of lawyer pushback. Most of those cases, almost all of them, end up by simply being worked out as we tell a story, they deny it, and everybody moves on. Not a lot of litigation. This one, though, as we began to move towards publishing, the Weinstein legal team got bigger and bigger, and the pushback on us became more and more intense. But I was very proud of the way that Jody and Megan proceeded with that story. The one thing that sometimes gets lost in the telling, and I try to resurrect that when I write about it, is that Megan Toohey went out and did a story about some questionable dealings that Harvey Weinstein had with a charity. It wasn't really related at all to the stories that were about to come. But I think it sent a message that we were not going to be intimidated, that we were going to be able to pursue tough stories about Harvey Weinstein.
I don't want to get too in the weeds, but you mentioned that the Harvey Weinstein, you know, legal force sort of, they mustered all their strength. And there was one lawyer in particular, David Boies, who was on the Weinstein team, but he had also done some work for The New York Times, right?
Yeah, his firm had done some work for The New York Times. And in fact, one of his partners was very ably handling a libel case, even as the Weinstein story was unfolding. And it was deeply disappointing to find out that not that David represented Harvey Weinstein. was clear that he was legally able to do that, represent clients other than us. What was deeply disappointing was his involvement with the company Black Cube, private investigators that were hired on behalf of Harvey Weinstein. And they were really intent on doing one thing, and that is to stop the publication of the story. I felt we deserved to be treated better than that by a law firm that we had a business relationship with. To attack our core mission was mm-hmm. simply unacceptable.
And to go after individual reporters.
That's right. When we had the confrontation with Boies Schiller over that, how do you justify this? What we were hearing was, this Black Cube was just trying to make sure that the truth got told. You don't have a monopoly on the truth. They were just trying to collect the facts and so that we could talk to you about what you had wrong, if you had anything wrong. But that's not really what the contract says. The contract is actually has a clause for stopping a publication of the story. Extra money, lots of extra money would come Black Cube's way. And at the end of the day, it came down to me to a simple question, and that is, what does following our reporters have to do with getting at the truth? And they were using fake people who were pretending to be in advocacy groups or otherwise, to contact our reporters and try to induce them to say things that could be spun against them.
Libel laws differ around the world, and we are now a global newspaper. I think the thing that a lot of people know about libel is very tough in the U.S. to bring a libel suit, very easy in the U.K. But what is it like when we're publishing here, mostly out of New York, but also all around the world, to readers nearly all around the world, except where we are blocked, like China?
We obviously have to pay attention to laws elsewhere. And the key to that, though, is to keep in mind that our core audience is right here, and we need to report what it is that is happening abroad to the best of our ability. Sometimes that means we challenge the law. Sometimes that means we go into court there. Most times it means that we are careful in getting the facts right, and we stand by the idea that the truth is going to matter wherever we are. And that's worked out to a great degree. I do have to say one thing, because I think it's important to the overall point of the book. One of the reasons we don't see as many foreign libel suits is that the Congress in 2010 passed a law that makes it almost impossible for people who win libel judgments abroad to bring them to the United States and enforce them, get our bank account.
This is a serious book on a very serious topic, but what most people outside the Times probably don't know is that you are not always serious. You can be very funny, and when you speak to journalists and you, even when you're instructing us on these kind of troublesome issues, people end up laughing a lot of the time. But there's a lot of humor in the way that you deliver sometimes grim news to us journalists here. And I imagine there has to be, just to end on a light note, was there ever any kind of crazy case or attempt to sue the Times that makes you laugh?
Well, it comes up all the time. But the one I was thinking about the other day in terms of libel was, we did a story about a guy who had become the most litigious man in New York. His divorce had lasted 13 years. And while he was in the middle of that divorce proceeding, he managed to sue his lawyer, his soon-to-be ex-wife's lawyer, this judge. He ended up suing his neighbors. I think he ended up suing some of the businesses around his house. We wrote that story, and of course, he sued us.
Perfect ending. All right, David McCraw, thank you so much for being here.
Appreciate it.
David McCraw is our Deputy General Counsel here at the New York Times and the author of a new book called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts. Alexandra Alter joins us now to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So I've been, for some reason, spending a lot of time writing about Broadway productions, and I think that's because there are many, many book adaptations on Broadway right now. I've been closely covering all the various legal scandals surrounding the Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird, based on the Harper Lee classic. This production was controversial before it even opened. There was a lawsuit months before the production opened when Harper Lee's estate sued Scott Rudin, the producer behind the show, saying that the script diverged impermissibly from the novel. Later, there was another skirmish. This was more recently when the Scott Rudin and the Harper Lee Estate jointly kind of went after these community theaters around the country who were putting on a much older version of To Kill a Mockingbird. This was based on Christopher Sergel's script, and it's been put on for decades. And a lot of these local theaters were caught off guard when they received letters telling them that they had to shut down their productions because they were in violation of copyright. This was a small scandal in the theater world. A lot of people love their local theaters, and so there was a huge outcry. Scott Rudin eventually relented and said, actually, you can put on the production. You just have to use my script, Aaron Sorkin's script. So now
some, can they do that?
So then the latest twist is that the publishing company behind the original script by Christopher Sergel is now seeking a remedy from the Harper Lee Estate through arbitration. They're asking for compensation of $500,000, and it is really complicated, but essentially there are two contracts, one from 1969 that Harper Lee signed and one from 2016 that Harper Lee signed, granting different theatrical rights to these two different scripts. And so the contention of, you know, the Broadway production is that when there's a Broadway production, you can't put on a production in a major city or anywhere within 25 miles of a big city. And they count a big city as a population of, I think, 150,000 or something like that. So this would include some smaller cities. And it's very interesting to see how it plays out. I think, you know, you might see some of these smaller theaters putting on a production that's on Broadway right now, which will be fascinating to watch. Other ones had to close their productions, though. They just simply didn't have time to learn a new script. They were days from opening, and they had to tear down their sets and things. So,
is this a power play, or is there money at stake?
That's a great question. I think it is a combination. I mean, I'm speculating a little bit here because, you know, while we did get the documents, we didn't get too much access to the thinking behind it, if I can say it that way, in terms of, you know, interview access and stuff like that. But I think it's pretty typical for when, you know, when there's a Broadway production, there's often a national tour afterwards. And most producers don't want there to be competition if they have plans to tour nationally. So that, I think, legally, the grounds are well set for them to protect their rights and say you cannot stage a production based on this work in these cities. I don't think there was real economic harm to be done from, you know, some of these are amateur theaters, mostly amateur theaters, I would say, with an all-volunteer cast. Some of them had children cast in the plays, and these are in very small venues. So I don't think that anyone would say, oh, I just saw To Kill a Mockingbird, I'm not going to go to the Broadway production. I think it's a pretty different audience. And I think Scott Rudin acknowledged that by saying, these venues aren't going to threaten our Broadway production, so go ahead and stage the Sorkin version.
So if you would-be scouts sort of disconsolate over having to memorize all of those lines
right.
for naught.
Exactly.
All
exactly.
right. That's not the only literary adaptation that you've been covering.
That's true. I recently wrote about Be More Chill, which is based on a novel by Ned Vizzini, and it became this viral hit when it was put on off-Broadway. The cast album, I think, was downloaded more than 200 million times. So it became this sort of grassroots fan favorite. And it was interesting to watch sort of that happen because, you know, Ned Vizzini, he was really a beloved figure in the young adult community, in the young adult literary world. And he tragically committed suicide about 5 years ago. There has been an interesting sort of renaissance of his work rather than fading. I think people have really rediscovered it through this Broadway production, and it's a musical, and it's a really unlikely musical. The story behind Be More Chill, it was his first novel, and he published it when he was in his early 20s. He started writing when he was a teenager and was very successful at it. And when he published it, it was a very sort of prescient story about technology. It features this teenager who wants to be cool, so he swallows this mini supercomputer that talks to him in his head and helps him have conversations with girls and deal with bullies and stuff like that. And it really kind of, I guess, foreshadowed the way technology now shapes our personalities and our interactions with other people. But when it came out in 2004, it was pretty ahead of its time. And it's not, you know, an obvious contender for a musical, but they really sort of pulled it off. And it's part of a wave, I think, of musicals like Dear Evan Hansen, which was actually reverse adapted into a young adult novel that really put a spotlight on the teenage experience, anxiety, depression, even though Be More Chill doesn't deal with suicide, Ned Vizzini's next novel, it's kind of a funny story, does, because it was based on his actual experience in a mental hospital after he had a brush with suicide when he was younger. And so it's interesting, I think, to watch the arc of his career kind of continue and the audience for his ideas and work grow, even though he's been gone for several years.
I also like that Broadway has to turn to novels now, not just Disney movies for
I like that, too.
Adaptations.
I think we should continue that trend.
All right. Here's to more. Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now are book critics Dwight Garner, Paul Siegel, and Jennifer Salai. Hey, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
Let's start with you, Dwight. What did you review this week?
Elsa Morante, the Italian novelist. There's a new translation of her novel, Arturo's Island, and the translation's been done by the great translator Anne Goldstein, who is well-known now, one of the few celebrity translators, I think you could say about her, for her translations of Elena Ferrante's novels. And Elsa Morante published her first work in the 1940s and published through the 1980s, four or five novels, and they're intense. Arturo's Island is about a young boy who grows up on this Italian island of Procida. And it's about, he grows up there sort of feral. His father's always gone. His mother died in childbirth. It's a coming-of-age novel of big, big emotions. It's the kind of book where people don't say things. They exclaim with vehement intent, you know, and there's always crashing seas and an old creaky house. And it's sort of an emotional horror story. And I had not read Morante before. And I've got to say, it wasn't quite for me. When I first picked it up, I thought, what is this? And I put it down after about 75 pages, as I say in my review. And I put it down, and I really put it down. I was not going to go back to it. But then I happened to pick up Lily Tuck wrote a biography of Morante about 10 years ago. And I read that, and she had a great life, striking, fascinating life, married to the novelist Alberto Morovia. And it made me want to go back to the book. The book started calling out to me, and I finished it, and I'm glad I did. It's not quite my thing. It's rich. I described it as gargoyle-like at one point, I think, in my review. But it kind of got to me, and I'm not going to forget it.
Did it make you want to now read more of her work?
Probably not.
Okay.
I'm glad to know. I'm glad to know she's out there. And I poked around in her other novels. One of them called History, and I read a fair amount of it, and it's slightly different, but basically the same. Her influence on writers like Ferrante is probably more important now than her own fiction. In Italy, her fiction was enormously influential, and like I said, influencing Ferrante among others. But in the States, her work never quite caught on, and I have trouble seeing this book catching on, even though it has a really distinctive flavor, and it's unlike anything you're going to read this year probably. But I'm not sure it's a specialized taste.
I feel like influential is going to be an operative word across all three of the books that you each reviewed, because, Parle, you reviewed a book that tells the true story, one that has been told and retold and continues to stay with us. What was the book?
I reviewed a book by Kara Robertson. It's called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, and it revisits the trial. I mean, this book is almost 20 years in the making, and Robertson kind of reopens the case and takes us through what happened in Fall River, Massachusetts, and sort of walks us through the trial, presents us with the evidence, presents us with some new information, some information from journals and Lizzie's letters. But the real interest in the book, and I think her real achievement, is really to look at not only what happened, but how it was written about and how it was understood in Lizzie Borden's time and how it's been understood since. And what I mean by that is that there's really like interesting media criticism in the book when she sort of goes back and she looks at all of the newspapers and the tabloids and the way that Borden was written about, the way the case was thought about, which was so interesting. You know, it was considered impossible that she committed this crime by virtue of being who she was, this, you know, well-born woman. And the fact that she was a woman became sort of the foundation of the case for the prosecution and the defense. You know, the prosecution saying, look at the nature of the wounds. This was done by a, you know, unnerved and unsure female hand. And the defense being like, what daughter could ever do this to her father? And and Robertson really just sort of very dispassionately, she's not choosing a side. She's giving us all the information we need. And it's clear that she wants the reader to come through and to make a decision. And then what she does, this one move at the end, which I really like, is that she then goes and takes us through history and says how each generation has found a different way to understand the case of Lizzie Borden. In the 1950s, you know, there were people that looked at her as the sort of feminist prototype. In the 1990s, there were these theories that she'd committed the murders, and it was coming out of sort of an incestuous and abusive relationship with her father. And then she looks at why open it now, and she compares her desire to study Lizzie Borden's case with this proliferation of true crime documentaries from How to Make a Murderer and The Staircase and Serial, and the way that, you know, we now want to look at these sorts of crimes and incidences from all kinds of different angles and with an eye to humanizing the person at the center and not, you know, not looking at them as a sort of cartoonish nursery rhyme story.
Tell us the rhyme in case there are some listeners, perhaps of a younger generation, who are not familiar with
Lizzie
Borden.
I don't think I know the rhyme.
Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. But of course, it's interesting because she killed her father and her stepmother, or so it was alleged, and the stepmother actually died with almost twice as many blows.
Wow.
So, you know, like all the best true crime books, I think it really opens up a picture not only of what happened, but the general sort of society at the time and all kinds of perspectives on gender and criminality and criminology. And it was a really good read.
I was in Australia a couple of years ago interviewing a novelist, an Australian novelist, who'd written a novel called See What I Have Done. And it fascinated me that this Australian novelist was so obsessed with this story that always felt to me kind of quintessentially New England in its...
Absolutely, yeah.
And there are also a lot of young adult novels around and true crime stories. I think even though Lizzie Borden herself was in her 30s, correct, when this has happened? So it's not like she was a child, but somehow it's this idea that I think fascinates teenagers. I wonder why, of, you know, with killing your parents. But does she in this book, does Robertson sort of try to steer you towards a conclusion?
Not at all. Not at all. It's very interesting how she does this. She really just sort of gives us all the theories, all the evidence. But again, as I say, she really wants, there's a feeling that she wants you to decide and you to make up your mind. And I don't know if she's actually very interested in if Lizzie Borden did it or not. You know, personally, I think her interest is in the trial. Her interest was in how this case was so disturbing in its time, not only because the crime was so intimate and so savage, but because it really upended ideas about criminology, who committed crime. So, for example, like the Fall River Police, they started their investigation by looking at immigrant communities, you know, looking at the French Canadians and the Irish, and they really could not believe that a woman could have done this crime, and particularly a white, well-born woman. So this is the reason that it sort of got that kind of scrutiny that it did in its moment. And as you say, since then, like, there is something about this case that just sort of gets its hooks into generations of people time and time again. It just has that, the consummate sort of closed room mystery. She couldn't have done it, but she had to have done it. But why?
Do you think she did it?
Do I think she did it?
Mm-hmm.
I think she did it. Yeah, I think she was the only one who really seemed to have motive and opportunity, as far as I can tell. But as they say, you know, don't at me on the internet. or do, I don't know. But just a really interesting woman, and who stays very enigmatic in this book. You know, that was my one grouse, just I wanted to come a little bit closer to her, but she even gives Robertson the slip.
All right, another very controversial woman. It's hard to imagine what Andrea Dworkin would have to face on Twitter today. Tell us about the book that you reviewed, Jen.
So I reviewed a new anthology of Andrea Dworkin's work called Last Days at Hot Slit, and it's edited by Joanna Fateman and Amy Scholder. So Dworkin died in 2005, and, you know, she was known as one of the most radical, I think, second-wave feminists, and known mainly for something she actually didn't say, but people always assume that her main point was that all sex was rape. And she never actually did write that, although she did write things that were pretty close to that. And she was known particularly for two books, Pornography and Intercourse, both of which are excerpted here. But this anthology also contains other pieces of her work, including essays, speeches, and actually a couple of excerpts from two novels that she published. And so I think it's really interesting to look at Dworkin right now because, for one thing, there's been a resurgence of interest in her work. And actually, a couple of weeks ago, one of the Times op-ed columnists, Michelle Goldberg, wrote a really great essay on this. And she really sort of contextualized why is it that Dworkin is resounding with a new generation of feminists, especially considering that Dworkin's views, especially on pornography and sex work, aren't particularly popular right now.
That's one of the things that I admire most about Dworkin, actually, is that I think she was right in large part about much of what she wrote about prostitution and about pornography. And those are both areas that are ripe for critique and attack, not only by men, but because they're both instances in which you could say that women are complicit in their own subjugation and objectification, you get attacked by women, too.
Well, and Dworkin, you know, it should be said, along with Catherine MacKinnon, you know, put together this anti-pornography ordinance in the early 80s. And you know, they endeared themselves in a way to evangelical Christians and people on the far right. And, you know, you can look at it from one perspective, which is probably Dworkin's, which is she felt that she was fighting a war. I mean, she does say something to this effect in her work. And so she was going to do what she needed to do. On the other hand, I think that especially now for a new generation of feminists, you know, the idea that sex work is a form of labor, I think that the notion of it is different from what it might have been in Dworkin's time. It's changed. And not only that, but it's just fascinating that somebody who had such strong, definite opinions on something, that her work would be speaking to this generation, I think not so much for the content of it, but actually for the form that it took. I mean, she was really, she was a really impressive writer. And she really thought very hard about how to communicate her point in a way that was, I mean, it didn't convince everyone, obviously, but, you know, she didn't shrink back from anything. And I think it's Intercourse where she says that her models were Dante's Inferno and Rambo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was always reading fiction, poetry. She read a lot of men. A lot of her, as they put it on the internet, a lot of her faves were problematic, and she knew it. So it is really fascinating to sort of see this. And I think the fact that she was so unapologetic, I think, about views that were very controversial, that weren't particularly popular,
yes,
that were extremely radical, that got her into trouble with all kinds of factions, I think that is part of what makes her so fascinating right now. And I think why, you know, some people are very curious about her work.
You know, growing up as a would-be male feminist, in reading around when I was, you know, starting to read in the 80s and 90s, there was always this sort of dichotomy. There was like the good feminist. There was someone like Gloria Steinem, who was somehow presentable and in the media. And then she'd be contrasted with Andrea Dworkin, who kind of, she sort of just stared at the camera with her arms crossed. And yeah, she had a look. And, you know, so good feminist here, bad feminist there. And I feel, after having spent my entire life thinking of her in largely negative terms that were defined by others for me, I feel sort of like I need to read this woman now.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because, you know, when Dworkin died, I think Steinem, I don't know if she said this or wrote a nice eulogy about Dworkin, but it was basically like, this woman was our oracle, our Old Testament prophet, who was basically speaking the truth that nobody really wanted to come to terms with.
It's great when a career turns around like this, isn't it?
I mean, just the culture. How was her fiction?
Her fiction is interesting. I mean, it's very autobiographical. She returns to certain incidents in her life in both books. I mean, the styles are very different. The first one, Ice and Fire, is sort of written in a more sort of minimal style. And then the second one, Mercy, is really sort of this rolling and very disturbing, but also in parts very funny. I mean, I should say darkly funny book. She's just really interesting to read. And there's nobody else who really writes like her, which I think is also something very surprising when people come to her work.
I wonder if there has to be some kind of fake Andrea Dworkin account on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Throwing flames.
I think it followed me at some point.
All right.
So
quick rundown of the books again, Dwight.
Arturo's Island by Elsa Morante, translated by Anne Goldstein.
Carl?
The Trial of Lizzie Borden by Kara Robertson.
And Jen?
Last Days at Hot Slit, an anthology of writings by Andrea Dworkin, edited by Joanna Fateman and Amy Scholder.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, albeit not right away. The Book Review Podcast is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with the great help of my colleague, John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.